welcome to episode 131 of Tea or Books. I'm Simon.
I'm Rachel.
And today we will be talking Reading Deeply or Shallowly, a suggestion from Heidi. Thank you, Heidi. We'll explain more in a moment. And in the second half, we will compare two of the British Library women writers' novels, One Year's Time by Angela Milne and Which Way? By Theodora Benson. Mm-hmm. It'll be too late by the time you hear this, but tomorrow, Rachel and I will be speaking at the Marlborough Literary Festival about the British Library women writers. I'm hoping we'll be able to record that and use that as a bonus episode, but it depends what the sound quality is like and if anybody there objects to us recording. But watch this space. Are you excited about it, Rachel?
I am excited. It's like we're actually real people.
I know, we've got real corporeal existence.
Yeah, we're going to be out in the reality. I mean, my only concern is that there'll be an audience of one. But you know what one person is? An audience. So
exactly.
We are.
I suspect most people there won't know who we are, but they will by the time, by the end of it. Well, the stars of it are the British Library women writers, not us.
But. Yes, they're all dead, but you know.
We're alive. Well, thriving. I say thriving. You've not been well, have you, Rachel? Have you been solaced with any reading on your sickbed?
Yes. Well, I mean, I've still had to go to work every day, the joy of being a teacher. But I have, actually. Well, it's been quite an exciting time, September, isn't it, for books? Lots of new ones coming out. So I've actually read this week Orbital by Samantha Harvey, which is not newly out, but it's on the shortlist for the Booker Prize and probably the shortest on the list, which is not why I read it, but there was a reason. I saw it when I went to the bookshop to get something else and thought, oh, that sounds wonderful. And it's set on a space station, and normally I don't like things set in space, particularly films. They're all the same, just full of people floating around. But this book is it's one of those books that's so well written and so beautifully written that you end up reading every sentence about three or four times. So even though it was only 120 pages, it took me just as long to read as it would a book three times as long, I think. But I absolutely loved it, and I would like to read more of her stuff now. So I've passed it on to a colleague at work who's very excited to read it next. And I'm currently halfway through the new Elizabeth Strout novel, Tell Me Everything. I love Elizabeth Strout. She's one of my favourite contemporary novelists, and I'm always so excited when her new book comes out, and I'm in a race to read it because my mum's waiting for me to give it to her when I've finished. So it's brilliant, and it's just like sinking back into a familiar world. I love how she incorporates characters from her other books into later ones, so you've got those sort of references, and it's like you're returning to a family of people that you know, but you're also learning new things about them that are shedding light on previous incarnations, and then you want to go back and read the other books again with that new knowledge in mind. So it's lovely. So yeah, I'm really enjoying those at the moment, and looking forward to reading our book for, shall we say, are we going to say?
I think we're not going to say who it is, but we've got a special guest, which we're very excited about in the next episode.
I'm looking forward to reading their new book, but I won't say what it is. Cryptic.
Yeah, I will. Well, just before I say, I'm interested about the space, because I'm with you. Like, I find books or films about space so boring. I find space so boring. I went to see First Man, that movie about Neil Armstrong. And ended up walking out after like half an hour. I was like, I can't watch him go up in a rocket again in silence for like 10 minutes. But maybe you persuaded me. But I've read, when I finished one, I'm reading another, two books that I think will be on my end of year list. They're both so good and very different. One is The Spring House by Cynthia Asquith, Lady Cynthia Asquith. Ooh. Who it's very hard to get hold of, but it's a wonderful Instagrammer called Old Book Dreamer, I think. And she always manages to find the most beautiful and wonderful and very hard to find books. And she actually didn't recommend this one. She recommended Cynthia Asquith's other novel, but this is the one I managed to get hold of first. And it's published in the 1930s, and it's set during the First World War with this young woman whose husband is in Canada as a soldier, not frontline, but he was there when the war broke out, so he's had to stay there. She's got a young son, they've turned their sort of big mansion into a hospital for soldiers. And it's basically about her life during the years, what is it, 1916 to 17, 1915 to 17, I think. So it starts, the war's already started and hasn't yet ended. Maybe it will before I get to the end of the book. But it's just so beautifully written, so immersive in that world. It's one of those times when I just feel completely transported to the book. It's maybe a little over like self-philosophizing. A lot of people have sort of conversations about themselves that you might not in reality, but I find Miranda, who's the main character, such a full, nuanced, interesting person, and it's very funny but also very moving. And it's one of those ones where I'm thinking, why has no one ever reprinted this? Because Cynthia Asquith is still relatively well known. She did a lot of anthologizing of ghost stories. That's where she's sort of most known in literature circles, but she wrote these two novels, I think two, maybe three, and they'd fit so well into Persephone or Virago or any number of other places. They sadly probably not the British Library, because it's set 20 years before it's written, and we try and do them set when they're written. And also we have another book coming up with the word spring in the title, so it might get confusing. But absolutely wonderful book, which if you ever have any chance of finding it, do. I mean, I had to pay quite a lot for this one, and it didn't come up easily. The other one, much easier to find and much more modern. Have you read Such a Fun Age by Kylie Reid?
I haven't.
It was Booker nominated 2020, maybe 2019. It was all very zeitgeisty then. And I just listened to the audiobook, and it was absolutely wonderful. The title is sort of meaningless, but it's about this young black babysitter in America for this white family it starts off with, they've got like an emergency, so they need to get their young child out the house. So they phone her being like, I'm sorry, I know it's just you're not down to babysit, but if you could come, it's an emergency. And she's out at a party. So she goes and gets the child. She's wearing like her party clothes. She takes her to a local shop. And while she's in that shop with this young white child, a white woman tells security that she thinks the child's been kidnapped. Yeah. So that's where it sort of starts, this big set piece of how she deals with being approached by security guard. There's a white man who's on her side who's filming it for in case she wants to like use it to expose the thing. And then it's basically sort of a satire of progressive white allyship from both the mother of the family she babysits for and this white man that she meets. But it's not sort of over the top, but it is, you go in feeling like it's going to be about, anti the sort of people who phone security or get security guards on black women in shops, but it's actually much more nuanced and much more exposing of the way that even the most well-meaning white people don't really understand what it's like to be black, or don't at all understand what it's like to be the victim of racism in modern day America. So yeah, it's really compelling book and really, really good audiobook. So I recommend that. I know everyone was reading it 5 years ago, but if you didn't read it then, you should read it now.
Okay, I'll get hold of it.
So yeah, lots of good reading suggestions there. So we're having good reading weeks. And Heidi got in touch with the topic for the first half, and she sent it. I don't think she meant me to read her whole email necessarily, but I think it's really good to set up what we're thinking about. So I'm just going to read a few paragraphs from Heidi's email. She says, "Do you always read deeply, searching for major themes, narrative devices, etc., or do you just as often read for pure pleasure of the writing, dialogue, etc.? Do you turn to Norton critical editions or find yourself down an online rabbit hole as you research literary work? Do you find that depth in our beloved Middlebrow books and not just the classics?" Some version of this question came to me as I was about to begin Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain. In the introduction, A.S. Byatt comments, "There is a way in which it is possible to read this 1,000-page tour de force as though it were a novel, though readers who set out to do so uncritically risk bafflement and disappointment. A daunting way to start. I considered looking for a Norton critical edition to ensure I got the most out of the book, and then wondered what your opinions are on critical editions. Do you use them or rely on independent research when reading the classics or heavier works? I am a constant reader of all types, fiction, non-fiction, classics, fun, and I always considered myself an intelligent reader until, during the pandemic, I was able to listen into my daughter's university lecture on Marilyn Robinson's Housekeeping, and realised that almost all of the themes and symbolism and motifs had been lost on me when I read the book. After this, out of humility, I bought and read How to Read Literature Like a Professor by Thomas Foster. Realising that you both have graduate degrees in literature and were trained to read deeply, and also realising Rachel is a professor, well done, you've been promoted, and therefore likely instilling deep reading skills in her students. How does that translate to your personal everyday manner of reading?
Well, first of all, I will say thank you for the compliment, but I most certainly am not a professor. I think it's probably different for me than you because it's my job to read deeply. And I don't think I can switch it off anymore. Mm. Maybe I could before I trained to be a teacher, but I think when you've done graduate study in literature, undergraduate study in literature, and like when you also spend every day talking about books and it's your job to unpick them for other people and to show them how to read, it just kind of comes naturally to me now. I don't even think about it, and actually it's quite difficult sometimes to explain to students why something's interesting but how do you notice that? I'm like, I don't know, I just do, it just happens now. It's just sort of it's kind of like driving a car after a while. I mean, I know it's you're not actively thinking when you're driving, your hand's moving the gears, your foot's moving the clutch, you don't think about it. And it's I think it's different if there are some books that I read deliberately so that I can switch my brain off, and I enjoy not having to think about it. But even this morning when I was sitting in bed reading the new Elizabeth Strout novel, I was still in the back of my head thinking, oh, I really love that image, and I love how she's referring back to this idea and how she's structuring this in terms of the seasons. And I was like, shut up, just read the book. it's something that's always there. Would I read a Norton critical edition though, or would I want to do lots of research behind a book? Not unless I were teaching it. I wouldn't say no. Unless something about it is like, oh, I really want to understand more about this writer in the context of their times because I've never come across them before. But no, I think I'd feel too much like I was back at university.
And just to clarify, what age do you teach, Rachel?
Secondary school, so 11-year-old.
So high school for Americans. Yeah.
Up to 18-year-old, yeah.
So, or maybe those are called professors in America, I don't know. They call anything a professor in America, don't they?
I'm calling myself a professor, why not?
Yeah, that's interesting. I liked that she singled out, do you find the same depth in middlebrow books? Because as listeners for a long time will know, I did a doctorate looking at middlebrow novels and the fantastic between the world wars. And I did have to sort of defend both in applying for that thesis or for that topic and various examinations or vivas along the way. And then even in the writing of the introduction, that I wasn't trying to elevate the middlebrow to classic status. I wasn't trying to say these books should be in the canon and they've been overlooked. I did write a little bit about, you know, anti-canonicity a bit. That's you know, the idea that of course that there shouldn't necessarily be a canon. But I did find often when I was writing that I would end up writing more, I guess, more sort of social literary studies, like what did these books mean to their readers, how do they respond to things that people are experiencing, how did particularly in my thesis looked at different societal anxieties at the time and how they manifested as different types of the fantastic. So, you know, there were far more women than men, so how did the issue of childlessness, for example, translate into fantastic creation of humans, that sort of thing, rather than necessarily sentence by sentence what can we find in this prose that requires a doctorate level critical analysis in the way, you know, it's very easy with something as rich as, you know, a Virginia Woolf novel to take a sentence and there'll be all sorts of things you can do with it because there's a richness and complexity to her prose that often middlebrow writers, whilst I think they're excellent at what they do, maybe a little more straightforward, and it would be harder to do that sort of line by line analysis. So I guess it's a different sort of critical approach, but maybe particularly at Oxford it did need a bit of defending to say, like, I think these things are worthy of study even if they're not what the Leavises might have considered part of the classics of literature.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point there about, I mean, the middlebrow fiction is really interesting to explore for its social function in terms of who was reading it and why, and what it tells us about the average life of a person at the time. But I think in any book, where no matter how, you know, shonkily written, not that I think middlebrow fiction is, there's going to be themes, there's going to be ideas, there's going to be turns of phrase, there's going to be metaphors. All of those things are still going to be present. You know, you can always engage with any novel on that level if you want to. And if people don't feel confident with literature, or don't feel that they have the training to be able to spot things, you know, you just start small. And like what we do at school, you know, you start off by thinking about characterization, and then you start out by thinking about themes, and you go sort of big picture, and then we start going a little bit deeper and looking at the language and things like that. So I mean, but you're, I think we can sometimes get caught up in thinking that great literature is only great if it's got beautiful prose, that, you know, you can, every other word in the line you can find seven different meanings for. But I don't think that's necessarily true. I think actually some of the best writing, and I think we had this discussion when we had Mary Lawson on, is writing where you actually don't notice the words at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, it's maybe most obvious with poetry, whereas where some 20th century and 21st century poetry reads very simply, but is still, you know, great, great poetry. Whereas if you're analysing a 17th century poem or something, then it's, I guess, already the distancing of it not being familiar language and not being familiar phrasing is going to be enough to require some analysis.
Yeah.
But I think the example that Heidi gives of housekeeping, I haven't done any critical work on housekeeping, but I think that's a novel that you can very easily enjoy, but either at a surface level or at a critical level. There's certainly nothing wrong with just reading that as a really interesting story of particular people in a particular place. Yeah. And as you say, it's not my job now. Well, it's never my job. I paid money to do it rather than getting paid to do it. But I was grateful that I was always able to switch it off. Even during my doctorate, I could be working on something all day and then be like, no, that part of my brain is off. Now I'm just going to enjoy this book and not think about it. And to an extent, you know, I see what you're saying. Like, I would still be thinking about themes, about patterns, about the beauty of the language if that was there, but in a sort of, in the same way that I might look out the window and see a nice view and be like, oh, that's lovely, but I wouldn't give it any deeper thought than that, I guess. And I find it hard to read things that are badly written, like if a sentence is, if the writing is very clunky or overwritten or anything, then I certainly can't turn off the part of my brain that responds to how well something is written. Because I've got friends who just said to me, like, I don't know what you mean by something being well written or badly written. I read something for the plot and for the, you know, the characters. I don't know what it means to have some good or bad style, which is, you know, fine. People in that position still really love reading, and that's great. But I certainly can't turn that part of my brain off. I imagine most people who listen to a books podcast can't turn that part of their brain off. But I'm not really thinking about it, I guess.
Yeah, interesting.
Critical editions. I don't know what edition you read the Zola in that we did last time. Was that a critical edition?
Well, it was just an Oxford World's classic. I mean, it was edited. And I did find the notes useful at the back for some of the contextual information, because, I mean, a lot of it I didn't know, because it's a French novel. So I don't know necessarily the history of Paris at the time. But some of the notes, I was like, well, I don't really care that the name of that street is now something else. Do you know what I mean? Like,
I found that there were bits where, because I don't often turn to these notes unless I'm actually feeling confused. And there was something that was like, oh, I don't know what that type of shop is or whatever. And I said, oh, there's a note. And I go there and it said, Zola also used this name in his short story published in. But it's like, well, I don't care about that. I want you to tell me what this word means or something. Yeah.
I do think that, I mean, sometimes those books can be useful. Like, the introductory essay is often useful once you've read it, if you want to understand more about it. Why on earth they insist on putting them at the beginning when they always spoil the plot, I don't know.
Well, this is why I was very keen with the British Library ones. They're not really critical in the same way, but I said when I started, can we put these as afterwards? Because I want to talk about the plot. I don't want, and I can't, I'm not going to do that properly if it's as an introduction.
Quite right, Simon. Thank you. Yeah. But I think there's a time and a place for those sorts of things. And but I think that, I don't know, I think people should never feel under pressure. I think reading ultimately should be for enjoyment and pleasure and enrichment. And nobody should feel guilty if they don't know lots of stuff about something, or they, you know, oh, I've missed this or I've missed that. It's not about missing things. If you've got something from it, and you've enjoyed it, then what have you missed?
Yeah, really good point. And when it comes to the online thing, I tend not to Google things whilst I'm reading or looking up other resources, because it just takes me out of the reading experience. And then I'm like, oh, I've got a WhatsApp, I should reply to that. Or whilst I'm here, I'll check Instagram, all that sort of thing. So I try and put my phone away if I'm got, you know, an hour that I can suspend reading. Sometimes if I'm reading an older book which just put lines in other languages in them, I might use my very handy translate app, where you can just hover the camera over the page and it translates it on the camera.
Yeah.
It's like we're living in the future now. But otherwise, what I often do is like, oh, I'll make sure to look that up later, and then instantly forget. And then notes in books, I do find, I don't know, because where do you end, I guess, when you're doing notes in an older book? Because I've read plenty where, you know, there'll be a mention of an ARP warden or blackout curtains or all these things that they're giving notes for. It's like, if this is your first time reading a book set, then that's really useful. But obviously, if you've read a million books set or written in the Second World War, then I don't need those anymore. So I always seem to be on a roller coaster between annoyed that they're there or or actually finding them useful or wondering why they're not there. I'm very hard to please when it comes to explanatory notes.
And I remember reading once a novel. I think it was it must have been a 19th century novel. And I was reading the notes, and everything I wanted a note for that I didn't understand, there wasn't a note. And then so they're like huge chunks of German, for example, in the notes. I haven't been German since I was 16. And no note at the bottom. It's like, brilliant, thanks for that. So I've got absolutely no idea what this means. I've now got to Google it. And sort of references to things that were really obvious were like, oh, this Queen Victoria came to the throne in England. Yeah. Yeah, great. Okay, everybody knows that. But like, what I don't know is what this word means or what that institution was or whether that was a real shop or not or whatever. Like, come on, who is this person?
Yeah.
Sometimes they can be spectacularly unhelpful. But I think there's a fine line between just allowing somebody to be immersed in this world and the expectation that, I mean, I find it interesting, this idea that there's, we talk about this a lot at school when I teach sixth formers, about the idea of how much context do you need in order to understand something and how much should you need, and can we read stuff without context and still appreciate it? And we look at different examples and think, oh, okay, well, I did sort of understand this, but now I know this, I get much more from it. And I think sometimes when it comes to historical context, which I think is often what these notes tend to favour in terms of what they actually give you, I don't think it's necessarily that helpful, because it's a fictional world that I'm immersed in. I don't need to know exactly what this person came to the throne or who this person was modelled on or whatever. I don't care. I just want to read the story. And it's really distracting having to flip back and forth the whole time and then pull out the story. And then, you know, the thing is, I'll look at the note and think, oh, okay. And then I'll probably end up Googling something. I'm so ADHD, it's hilarious. And then I'll be like, half an hour later, I'll be like, oh God, I was actually reading the book, wasn't I?
Yeah.
a lovely little rabbit hole on Wikipedia looking up all these people. And for me, I just want to read the book. So I also, you know, spent a lot of time at university having to pore over that sort of thing and feeling that it was very important. And I think now I'm much more independent, and I'm apparently the expert in the room. I don't feel like I need them as much. I can, and the thing is, again, it's not to sound arrogant or anything, but you know what I mean, when you know as much as we do about literature because it's what we do, you do have this enormous range of information and other stuff, that like stuff that when I was 18 at university I would have needed all those notes for. I don't need them anymore. You know, it's been 20 years since I was at university for the first time. And it's kind of, you know, a lot of that stuff now is just background knowledge. But I can see how it's useful for other people, but it's not for me necessarily.
I also think it's interesting that distance in time is considered something that should have notes for. So if something is set or written a long time ago, yes, but distance in geography isn't. Like, I'm just as likely to have encountered something I don't know in a novel set in America or anywhere that's not the UK as I am, well, more likely really than a book set in England in the 1930s. So I mean it's a very trivial example, but I probably said before, when I was reading Sweet Valley University as a teenager and it referred to a girl's bangs, and this was before in Google. I couldn't look it up. It's like, what are you talking about? I don't know what bangs are. And, you know, no one was going to footnote. I mean, no one's doing a critical edition of Sweet Valley University. But
job for you.
But yeah, I mean, that's a trivial example. But even in, you know, Such a Fun Age that I just read, there's all sorts of expectations that I'll understand what that sort of supermarket is like, or those sorts of products that people are looking at in the supermarket. It's like, I don't know what any of those things are.
Yes, and, but you can sort of work it out. That's the thing. And I think
that's
what's quite infantilizing sometimes about notes in books. It's like, but actually, if you just let people look at the context of a sentence, they can work it out for themselves that this person was obviously important, or, you know, that this was a shop that this type of person went to. Mm. You know, you can do that. And I think sometimes we can become a little bit over reliant on those things, or think that they're important when actually they're not. They're just providing an academic with a job.
Yeah.
Lecturer at university, he'd done the notes for the edition that we done. She was like, it cost me money to do these rather than getting paid anything because of the amount of time it took her. So I don't think it's a particularly sought after gig either. But
yeah, just something to get on a CV, isn't it, before you do your own monograph. Well, and we've ranged over different areas there, but reading deeply or not reading deeply, Rachel?
Well, I think, you know, you should always read as deeply as you can to get what pleasure you want from it. But I think, you know, as a teacher who often teaches people who would rather not be reading whatever it is that we're reading, I would say that whatever you find value in, or whatever level that you're enjoying, is absolutely fine. And I don't like snobbery around needing to read things alongside stuff, or needing to understand on a certain level. I mean, if you're interested and you want to, then great. But I don't think that I don't think any good book is inaccessible without notes. Any good book should, you know, be accessible to everybody wherever they're at when they come to it, basically. That's my view.
So is that yes or no?
I just do it. So I mean, yes.
Okay, you can be yes. That's fine. Yes, great. I'm going to be a no. I think I like turning my brain off and just enjoying a story. Said Doctor of English. Just to wheel that out of my Viber. We have a question from Louise for the middle section, which is basically which books have houses that are particularly memorable to us, which houses sort of houses characters, I guess, which we could talk about for a long time. In fact, episode 85, we did talk a lot about, we did one house versus many houses for novels. But I thought maybe we could just pick three books each, maybe that where we particularly remember that the houses are very significant, or we remember the particular house very, you know, as of being very memorable part of the book. Because I've not warned you, I can do my three first, if you like.
Thank you. I'm frantically thinking. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I picked, it'd be interesting to see how many we mentioned in episode 85. The Haunted Woman by David Lindsay, which I think is probably not a very good book, but I did love it when I first read it. And that is about this enormous house which has a staircase with secret rooms at the top. And when people come back from the staircase, which moves around the house at different times, they don't remember what's happened in those rooms. So the architecture of the house is basically the fantastic element of the novel, and it becomes very metaphysical towards the end. But I loved that idea. I love the idea of secret rooms in general, but the idea that it moves around and then you forget what's happened there when you come back, loved it. The Air by Vita Sackville-West that we might have done on the podcast ages ago. This man who inherits this enormous house and is very sort of just more annoyed than happy about that, and just wants to get rid of it. But then gradually over the course of the novella falls in love with the house. And it's basically like a romance between him and this house, really. And then my third one, Louise, is nonfiction, The House by the Sea by Mae Sarton, one of her journals. I can't remember where it falls in the series, but it's... she's living in this remote house near the sea, and it's partly about her writing career, as those journals always are, but it's also about that house, about feeling a bit isolated, enjoying the isolation, but she's also very worried about, you know, if she has a fall, will people find her? So it's both the sort of romance of living in this beautiful isolated place, but also you really feel the, I guess, the dangers of that house as well. So it's, I guess, because I deliberately didn't pick anything super gothic, partly because I thought maybe you would, but it's sort of like the, what would that elements of that gothic sense of house mean in reality for someone?
Okay. Right. Well, I think my first choice would be to the lighthouse. Wolf. I love the house and how it becomes a character, particularly in the middle section, where it's sort of falling apart and it's been abandoned. It's one of my favourite books to teach, actually. And it's, yeah, that just that house by the sea and the way that she describes how the light comes into the room and the sounds of the floorboards and how the light tracks around during the day. It's just beautiful. And that sense of being on holiday, but also how the house is a kind of vessel of memories. And yeah, it's beautiful. So that's one of my most memorable ones. I have to say, Mandalay and Rebecca.
I was going to be astonished if you didn't mention Rebecca. I'm glad you did.
I think it's such an amazing, it's such an amazing gothic novel, isn't it? But also that house that's so central to the personality of Rebecca, but also Mrs. Danvers. So yeah, I love that. And what would I say my third one would be? There's lots of potentials, but I think probably Jane Eyre. Because of the way you've got the attic, you've got the rest of the house, and then you've got the house that she goes, the Ferndean at the end that she goes back to, and this house in the hollow, and thinking about, like, has she gone from bad to worse? I mean, just wonderful. And the also the contrast in sort of the school at the beginning, that the like the spaces that she inhabits throughout different phases of her life, all of them are metaphorical for her state of mind, I think. Here we go. Look, I can't help reading deeply, can I? I think that's really powerful and a really clever use of setting to explore the psyche. So yeah,
great. And I will say I love books about houses or where houses are main characters. And I particularly, my favorite thing is when people go house hunting in a book, because it can be done really amusingly or really so any recommendations, do let us know books about houses. I will almost certainly read them.
I'm surprised, actually, Simon, you didn't mention Beverly Nichols.
That's true. I mean, I did write this long list, and I, you know, Shirley Jackson I wanted to get in, and all sorts of other people, but I had to restrain myself. And I probably talked to them all about them in episode 85. Who knows? I will just say the best house hunting / buying a house and it falls apart book, I think, is... Buttercups and Daisies by Compton Mackenzie.
Okay.
Actually, Building a House and Make Fall Apart is Mr. Blandings Builds His Dream House by Eric someone. Is a very funny comedy of errors about trying to build a house. Anyway, I need to stop. It's too many house books. So on to One Year's Time by Angela Milne and Which Way by Theodora Benson. Which would you like to introduce us to?
I'll do Which Way, please.
Fab. Do you want to start off?
Okay, so I can't actually remember. I'm blaming this on my cold. I can't remember the name of the character. You have to give it to me.
Claudia.
Claudia, that's it. So Claudia is a woman living in the 1920s, and she's got quite a nice life. And she's sort of comfortable. She's very fashionable. She doesn't need to work. Her life is sort of a little round of parties and having a good time. She doesn't particularly want to get married. But her best friend has just got married, and she's a little bit like, oh, what am I going to do with myself now? And then it feels like we're just reading this sort of conventional novel. And then suddenly we have this situation where she, one morning she wakes up, she goes into the room, the phone rings, and she's got the option of going to a party and will she decide to go or not? And she does. And then we see what happens there. And then we come, once that bit of the story is finished, we come back. And then we're back in the room again, and she's got the option to go with a different version of that day where she doesn't go to the party, she does something else instead. And then we have then that happens a third time. And it's interesting to see how in those three different, it's a bit like sliding doors, which of the options where she would have ended up and the commonalities between the three lives. So yeah, that's the premise. Very interesting one.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you. And 1 year's time is, I guess, also has a sort of narrative technique to it, although less experimental. It's just what over the course of 1 year for Liza, and it's her romantic and professional life. So she meets this guy called Walter towards the beginning. You see her at the beginning painting the floorboards in her flat, as you do. And it's, I guess, sort of Noel Coward-y dialogue between these two characters, sparring, quite surprisingly explicit at times, or not explicit, but you know, it's not as coy as you might expect from a 1940s novel set just before the Second World War. Well, I don't think it quite clarifies, but it's certainly before the Second World War. We go through her year of what happens with Walter, with her group of friends, with her office job, and what will and will not have changed by the time the year is up.
Mm.
Yeah.
And these are both British women libraries, British library women writers' books, you should mention.
They are. And in fact, they are both books that were literally impossible to get copies of on the secondhand market before they were reprinted. I read them both years ago in the Bodleian Library, and had to do that again when I was recommending again. All the other ones, however hard they've been to find, we've been able to find at least some secondhand copy to work from, but these ones were all but lost to time.
Wow.
And you read them both for the first time now, is that right?
That's right, yes. And I was most intrigued by Which Way, because you'd said it was like Sliding Doors, and I was really interested to see how she dealt with that as a concept. And I did think, is it going to be, I don't know, a bit repetitive or something? You know, I wasn't sure how I would feel about it. But I actually really loved it. I found it really compelling.
Oh,
I
was good.
Desperate to be like, okay, what's going to happen? So, okay, so next time. And I found it really interesting the way that, particularly the, is it Guy, the person that she, so she.
Yeah, I think that's right.
She kind of has this relationship with, she has three very.
Oh, Hugo, sorry.
Hugo, she has three different, very different relationships in each of those three lives. And the one that's, I thought the one that was most powerful to me was the one where she gets married to Hugo, isn't it? Mm. And it's the most conventional path that she should take. They're very good friends. They get on so well. And he asks her to marry him. And, you know, she's like, well, I'm not really sure that I love him like that. But yeah, why not? You know, this is what marriage should be. And you see what happens when that takes place. And I thought for a novel of this time, it's really quite daring to sort of suggest that actually you need sexual attraction and you need that kind of thing to keep a marriage going. Mm. And she doesn't feel that way about him, and it's I thought really quite refreshing. And she ends up having an affair because she's not happy. She knows that she can't go on like this forever. And this exploration of what it means to find happiness as a woman, and when everyone else in your social world is telling you that you will only be happy when you get married, or marriage and children is going to provide you with everything that you need to be happy, and realizing through each of these three different stories that actually no matter what path she goes down with a man, that's not necessarily going to be true, I thought was, yeah, actually quite unique. I've not read another novel of this time like it.
Yeah, I think what's quite clever about the way she sets it up is, as you say, she has these three invitations that she can accept, and each one she's sort of aligning in her head with a different man. So there's yes. one that Hugo's invited her to stay, then there's one where she might meet this sporty guy, there's one where she might meet this intellectual guy. And you sort of expect when you go into them, she'll be like, oh, then she'll have the romance with whichever man she meets. But it's cleverer than that. Like, she goes to some and actually she ends up back with one of the other men, or she ends up single, or she ends up with one, but then having an affair with another one. So, because she gets to the point at the end of each section where she says, oh, it would have been so much better if I'd taken that other invitation, because then I'd have been with XYZ. And you think, oh, no, you wouldn't have done, because I've seen yeah. what happened. And yeah, it goes beyond just, obviously, just that evening. We see months, and I can't remember if it's years, but for quite a long time after that seemingly insignificant decision. And I thought she did Theodore Robinson did a good job at creating three sort of archetypes, because you do get the very sporty guy who's not very clever, you get the very intellectual guy who's not very kind, and you get the sort of friend who, she, as you say, she's not, as it turns out, necessarily attracted to. But they all felt real to me, and they all felt, because they don't have masses of space. It's quite a short book, even though you've essentially got these three different novels in there. But they felt like genuine people with enough nuance that you think, yes, that person could exist, and that is probably how she would respond to them.
Yeah. I felt that they were all very well-rounded, and I loved, that sort of element when you get to the end and her being like, if only I'd just ended up marrying you, my life would have been different. And it's like, well, yeah, it would have been. And
not the way you think, yeah.
Sleeping with him. And I thought it was, yeah, just it. Her as a character, Claudia as a character, is so well realised. She's so, I don't know what it, I can't really put my finger on why I found it so compelling to read, but I think she was such an interesting character and so introspective, and you really have access to what she's thinking and feeling, and there's an honesty to the book, I think, that I found quite compelling. And I loved all the period detail, and I loved, just this kind of interesting idea about, as well, I love anything where it explores how a life can turn on one decision that at the time seems really insignificant, but by going to this thing, you've now met this person, or you haven't met this person. And it does make you think about, I don't know, it always makes me think like, oh gosh, you know, what things could I have missed out on by not, I mean, in my life experience, you never miss out on anything by not going to a party. But it's interesting to, I think that concept does really intrigue people, and I think it's a difficult one to carry off and to knit together. And I think that she does it really well. And I loved her style of writing. And I don't, has she written more?
She wrote maybe 6 or 7 novels. I've only read one other one, which is Concert Pitch, which wasn't very good, sadly. Okay. And she did a few nonfiction things about like the countryside, like comic things. I'm trying to think what her, if she's got a more famous one. I'm not sure she has. She's not related to any of the other Benson clans. She's not an E.F. Benson relation. There's certainly the others that are easier to find on the secondhand market. Obviously, this one is very easy to find now because it's in print. But, I think that same honesty and surprising honesty is there in 1 year's time. In fact, the conversations I had with the editorial team, they were a bit worried about publishing it because it felt too modern for the time. It's like, well, it was actually published at the time, so you know, we managed to get past that. But I thought if someone was setting a novel now in the 1930s, I think it would be more demure in some ways, or there'd be things, you know, you wouldn't expect the main characters to sleep together that early, particularly, well, from that class at least. He wouldn't set that. And I thought, if you've read my afterword, you'll see this. There was sex and money seem to be the two motivating factors throughout. So Liza's not poor, but she does need to work. And she's got, she's also got a passive income inherited from a relative. But she's always thinking about how much things cost. And, you know, if they're going out to dinner and someone doesn't pay their way, she notes that down and all that sort of thing. But at the same time, I thought it was really interesting that she was trying to be much more sort of independent and I guess sexually progressive than her parents' generation. But at the same time, there's that fear for her throughout, like, I have to lock down a husband, then I'll feel safe. And she uses the word safe at one point for that. Whereas he's entering this relationship, he's slightly thoughtless, this Walter guy. I don't think he's thinking, I'm taking advantage of her, or I have privileges that she doesn't. But he can go in thinking this is just a bit of fun and hopefully it'll turn into something. And she's going in thinking it is a bit of fun, but it has to turn into something for me. Otherwise, where will I be in 10 years' time?
Yeah. And I mean, I have to say, I didn't enjoy this one as much.
Oh, no.
And I actually did give up halfway through because I just couldn't bear Walter anymore.
He is pretty annoying, it's fair.
And I found the conversation very repetitive, and I also hated the fact he called her Ducky, and I just wanted to punch it. Anyone call me Ducky ever, that would be it right there. no going further. I certainly won't be spending a year of my life with them, that's for sure. So I think I loved all the things that you've mentioned. I think it's a very, I was surprised. I was like, oh, right, okay, that's where we're going straight away. All right, fine, great. wasn't expecting that at all. And I love the description of her at the beginning, you know, painting her the floor of her flat, New Year's Eve. She's like, I've got nowhere to go. And that feeling of life not moving forward, of that sort of in your early 20s when you feel like everybody else's lives are, everybody's doing something more exciting than you, and you were expecting life to be more than this, and you know, you're just working in a rubbish office job and spending your evenings at home not doing anything, and you've got no money. I remember those days very well. And so it's, I loved that, and I love the description of her office as well. I love the people who worked there. The woman particularly who only has one jumper and has to keep dyeing it. I thought that was,
yes, oh, that was brilliant.
And that kind of office politics and the sort of the jealousy of the other women. And I think what this book does bring out really quite powerfully is how important it was for women at that time, status wise, to have a man and to have been chosen and to have to be married so that you could be seen as being, as having made it, essentially, that you'd achieved something in life. Because when you got married, you didn't have to go to work anymore, and you'd be at home, and you'd have that status, and everybody would look at you differently. And I think it was really touching when she had to go and buy that wedding ring so that they could go together into the countryside, and her being worried the whole time that what people were going to think. And Walter never has to think about that. And that sexual politics of men being able to do whatever they want and women having to bear the consequences hasn't changed. And I thought that was really refreshing. What I didn't enjoy is I found it slow, and also the dialogue impossibly twee, and I couldn't bear it anymore after a while.
I did think when I was suggesting this one that people will either be like me and absolutely love the dialogue. It felt to me like, what, as I say, like watching a Noel Coward play. I just love them sparring against each other, and I thought it was really fresh and fun. But I also thought some people are going to hate this. So yeah, I was right. Because it does. I mean, they don't speak like normal people speak, which, and that's, you know, either you want naturalism in your dialogue. Well, maybe you don't even want naturalism in your dialogue, but this sort of stylizing thing might put people off. But if you're the sort of person who, like me, likes things to be slightly unrealistic and in a sort of, I know it does, it's like no one speaks like they would in a Noel Coward play, and maybe you only enjoy that in a Noel Coward play setting, but if you want that sort of thing in a novel, then I think people might enjoy this.
Yeah, I think it's very much, the dialogue is very much of its time, and it is, but it's, they say things to each other that I just think really, like, it's just, it was just soppy after a while, particularly I found her soppy. And I understand that she's treading a tightrope, essentially, because she wants him to marry her. But in order to get him to marry her, she's got to play games the whole time. She's got to make him think that she doesn't want him to marry her because she doesn't want to be too needy. And I think all of these things are very true for women in general. But saying, oh, I do love you, ducky. Oh, I do love you. Oh, I do love you, like, constantly. It's like nobody says this to each other. I just found it annoying. And I will say this, I think Noel Coward would be turning over in his grave being compared to this, because his is way much funnier than this. I just think it was I could have done with less of them talking and more of their thinking about their, well, more about sort of what he's not doing. And I think it was all just a bit, I don't know, I can't put my words to it today, but it was, I just found it like there was just too much of it, and it weighed it down, weighed the story down.
Okay. Yeah. Something that I think both novels do, you sort of alluded to it, is the women are very much feel they have to filter their personality to what the man wants. Because I think with Claudia, we're not just seeing her with three different men, we're seeing her as three different versions of herself, and they're all recognizably her, but she's like bringing different parts of herself to the fore. There's this sort of lowbrow comedian that she goes to in two of the stories, or two of the sections, one where she's appreciating it from a sort of ironic, detached sort of way because that's the person she's with, and the other one where she's enjoying it in a sort of this is silly fun sort of way because that's the person she's with. And in both cases, she's looking down on the person who might look at it a different way. So I thought that was really clever that, you know, she has it in her to either go and just enjoy it ironically or enjoy it wholeheartedly. But it just depends who she's with. And she is just like a strong, interesting character, but she's also malleable to the men she's with. And in a way, both the three men in that book, well, maybe not Hugo, but the other two men and Walter in 1 year's time, I don't think they're at all malleable in their personality. They're not changing based on who they're with. They're not, and it's not because they're being thoughtless. It's just society doesn't demand it of them. It doesn't cross their mind. So I thought both of them brought that across it. Maybe more Liza. Liza also has quite a lot of internalized misogyny. Like she's looking down on women she describes as bachelor girls. She's looking down on women who are sexually progressive but get pregnant outside of marriage. That's when she's like, well, that's, you know, they've been stupid there. There's she's looking down on people for doing the same, for behaving in a way or having things happen to them that she fears for herself, I guess.
Yes. I think they're both really quite feminist in a way, because they're looking at women's lives with very clear lenses and the reality of how women do have to manipulate themselves and change themselves and are expected to pander to what men around them want them to be in a way that men don't. And even though, you know, they might be treating the topic in quite different ways, I think, you know, it is, you can tell from Angela Milne, is that how name it is? Yes, Angela Milne, like, you know, even though I found Eliza annoying as a character, I could see what she was doing through writing her in that way, being like, isn't it a shame that we have to be like this, that she's really having to contort who she is and put up with this in order to be safe and be secure, because society won't give her another option, essentially. It's not Liza's fault that she's like that. She's kind of pressured into it, and the other options for her aren't particularly great. I mean, her office job, bless her. I mean, who'd want to do that? I wouldn't. she does, just even what the company does. I love that. Something to do with music, but none of them really know what they do. But I think it's for me, like, it was interesting in which way to think about which way I liked the best for her, which one I was the real one that she'd taken. And I don't know what you thought about that. If you had a particular story you wished had been the real one.
Yeah, it's interesting because I'm always very pro people who are contentedly single in a novel. So I liked that outcome for her. Maybe not contentedly, but not too miserably. But I did, rereading it this time, I actually really, really did like Hugo in the bit before she gets the invitations. I'd forgotten how charming he is there and how much of an actual just nice person he is. So whilst we see that it doesn't really necessarily work out the way they'd hope, I think that's probably still the direction I'd have wanted her to go in and then hope it could adjust. But I don't know. I think all of them, all of these three men, I don't think she should end up with. So I prefer the one where she's ends up single. How about you?
Yeah, I felt the same way. I was like, with each of the men she was with, she had to compromise so much of herself. And to me, she seemed most contented when she was by herself at the end. And I thought that Theodora Benson wanted to make that point. So I enjoyed that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting comparing to Sliding Doors. And I think the only other novel I can think of like this is The Versions of Us by Laura Barnett, that this one doesn't do parallel stories. It does do them in sections, and I found that I was very glad about that, because I mean, The Versions of Us by Laura Barnett, I think, I can't remember if there's three or four different outcomes based on whether or not someone gets in the way of a bicycle, and I just had no idea what was going on, because I mean, the same people were in all of them, and it was so confusing. One of them, she ended up being pregnant at the time the bicycle investor was like, well, how did getting out the way of a bicycle make her get pregnant several weeks ago? I don't know. So I didn't like that at all. Sliding Doors works better, I guess, because she cuts her hair in one of them and then you can, you know what's going on. But I liked that it was set up, because I guess it's less formally experimental, but But I think it's the better for that, because it also takes you back to that starting point each time. So you've got to an end, and then you're like, oh, let's whisk back, rather than only seeing that starting point once and then following all these different things, which I think would have got very confusing.
Yes.
And I think it's a rare book that I wish would have been a bit longer, because I did feel like I'd like to spend a bit more time in the sections, the different she goes down.
I would have been happy with another couple of versions as well.
Yeah, true. One said she just went to bed instead of going to any of these parties.
It would have been nothing. Just stay at home and watch Netflix.
Yeah. That's what I keep doing, and my life has not turned out to be exciting. So, so, let's do our decision making. I think I know which way you're going to go. Which way? But just to confirm,
I'm going with which way for this one.
And I'm going for 1 year's time. I really love it. I did think you wouldn't like which way, and I thought you would like 1 year's time. So I'm still getting you wrong all these years in.
I'm just so unpredictable.
Yeah. But obviously I love them both. That's why I suggested them for the series. That was a given, I guess. But yeah, 1 year's time I think is a really, really special book if you can cope with a hero who's really annoying. Yes. I don't think we're meant to like him. I hope we're not meant to like him. And I didn't mention, but in case you're wondering, yes, Angela Milne is related to A.O. Milne. She was his niece, and this was her only novel.
Wow.
There you go, which we'll be talking about a little bit more at the Marbury Literary Festival tomorrow.
Yes, looking forward to it.
And yeah, as Rachel hinted, in our next episode, we're not going to actually do a couple of books. We're just going to do the one book in discussion with the author. The reason I'm not saying it is in case it like falls through and I don't want to get people's hopes up. But I will say we get offered guests relatively often, and I've usually not heard of them. But Rachel and I only say yes if we both already love the author. And we're really excited about the person who's coming on the next episode. So we'll speak to you then.
Thanks for listening, everyone.
Bye.